This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The podcast where we talk to smart people, but not necessarily done by smart people.
That is an awesome question.
This one goes down probably on one of my top five.
Hey, I like nutrition. I like to eat food.
This is the coolest thing ever. We're going to do this forever.
I wish I paid more attention in that class.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't understand that. As a man, I don't get it.
Welcome to SmartPeoplePodcast.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Smart People Podcast. I'm Chris Stem.
And I'm John Rojas.
Have you guys gotten a chance to check out our new website yet?
I know I have.
Of course you have. You've spent all of your time on it.
It was worth it, though.
It is pretty cool. I really like it. I'm not a big fan of change sometimes, but I like that. So head on over, check it out. Let us know what you think. And thank you, by the way, for leaving reviews. There have been a bunch recently, and it's not only is it fun to see, but man, you guys are nice, so appreciate that. This week, we kind of get into John's world, but I will say that I was really pleasantly surprised because there's so many things you can learn. Even when you think you're talking about one topic, it just makes you expand your thought process.
Well, one of these days, you'll learn that there is a technology layer on everything.
Well, it's really annoying. I don't like it.
Listen, Grandpa, you need to accept it. And this week, we're talking to Larry Downs. He's a co-author and research fellow at Accenture's Institute for High Performance. And he was fantastic.
He was. He's also a consultant and speaker on developing business strategies in an age of constant technological disruption. His most recent book is called Big Bang Disruption, Strategy in the Age of Devastating Innovation. And we touch on a lot of cool things here. We're not going to talk about it too much. One thing I did want to say is he wrote a book 15 years ago called Unleashing the Killer App, and it was named by Wall Street Journal one of the five most important books on business and the internet ever published.
Ever.
So that was kind of important. We touch on that book as well. Hope you guys enjoyed this interview with Larry Downs. Larry, thanks so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it. Can't wait to kind of dive into your newest book, Big Bang Disruption, as well as some previous things you've written, which are great. Prior to doing that, though, I really was hoping to get a feel for what you're up to now and how you got to kind of where you are and the success you have achieved.
Sure. Well, this new book comes about after a 2+ year research project I've been doing with my colleagues at Accenture. But, you know, I've been working in the area of disruptive innovation and technology and its effect on business really more or less my entire career. So in some ways, this is a big project, but in other ways, it's kind of continuation of something I've been doing for a long time.
As I mentioned in the intro here, I was just learning about your previous book, Unleashing the Killer App. And I didn't plan on really discussing it, but it's received such acclaim and it's renowned as one of the best business and technology books. I was hoping you could touch on that. You know, that was over 15 years ago, which is kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, it feels like about 50 years ago to me.
Well, in the title, you say the killer app. How do you believe the idea of the app has changed since then?
Well, you know, in some ways it hasn't changed. I mean, the idea of killer app was this idea of a product or service that kind of entered the market, and by being so disruptive and so much better than things that it was competing against, really undermined existing industries, kind of changed the thing, kind of created new categories, and gave consumers a whole new way of looking at some activity or some function, or even in some cases, you know, an entire sector of the industry. In many ways, what we've seen in the 15 years since killer apps is kind of the equivalent of disruptive innovation on steroids. You know, the economist Joseph Schumpeter said capitalism is defined as a perennial gale of creative destruction. And that's never been more true than it has been in the last decade. In fact, what we're seeing is kind of, you know, perennial gale of creative destruction on steroids. And in the new book, what we looked at was really what's happened in that last 10 years, because even though the internet continues to be a very disruptive force, what we found was that the nature of innovation had changed, and not just in high-tech industries. In fact, maybe even more outside of high-tech industries, because of the kind of continued improvement, you know, exponential growth, as we say, of many technologies, including computers, but all sorts of other technologies as well.
You know, it's interesting, again, looking back, do you feel like you had a decent idea of where it was going? I mean, so in 1999, do you think you would look and say, you know, in 2014, they'd be ordering taxis via their smartphone and streaming music anywhere and et cetera, et cetera?
Well, yeah, I'm laughing because I'm thinking about killer app. I mean, I'd say that we got probably every single example in the book is wrong. many of them are companies or products or services that, you know, had their moment in the sun and then disappeared. Some of them, you know, we wrote about Amazon, we wrote about eBay. So we had some things right, but, you know, Google didn't exist when we were writing. Smartphones certainly didn't exist when we were writing. And I think if I go back to the principles that we talked about in the books and the rules that we said, you know, were emerging for electronic commerce and very early internet business, I think those rules turned out to be pretty good. And I think many of them are still in effect. But all of the predictions we made about particular companies or particular technologies, no, not so good.
Were some of those companies just ahead of their time? Because I know during the whole dot-com bubble, there was all these things where people said, oh, the internet's going to change everything. But it really didn't, because our connectivity was so slow, downloading stuff and connecting with other people. It really took too long to grab people's attention. Do you think that some of those companies, if they existed now with broadband, could possibly still be around?
I think that's a very good point. And I think in some cases that's true. And in fact, one of the examples we give in the book is we talk about ebook readers. So back in, you know, 1998, 99, there are already companies trying to sell electronic book readers. And it wasn't so much the broadband in that case, it was more the display technology, the battery technology. Those just were not ready for prime time. And then, in right. fact, the processors just weren't fast enough or cheap enough to really make an effective product. And in some ways, kind of the genius of Amazon in that example is they didn't launch their product until it was clear that the technology was there. And that, in fact, several technologies had come together, storage technology, broadband technology, display technology, battery technology, all those things were ready. And that's the moment at which they launched the Kindle. And that's why it had that kind of a big bang take up where millions of people, you know, bought it after nobody was buying several earlier attempts by other companies. So I think, yeah, a big part of it is, you know, kind of timing the technology. And again, not just network technology, but a lot of technologies. But, you know, particularly in 1999 and 2000, after Killer App had come out, we saw so many examples of just bad ideas, bad companies, bad management. You know, people really didn't know how to run a business who kind of said, oh, we're going to be, you know, internet for pet food. We're going to be, you know, the internet for, I don't know, for helping men get dates. It was all this crazy stuff that just, you know, did not really, let's just say it wasn't very well thought out. There was a lot of money around. So a lot of these companies got funded when they never should have in the first place. And I think a big part of the bust was just bad business.
I've never thought about that. It's funny. All the conversations John and I have had or people we've discussed, it was such a new paradigm. It was like the wild, wild west where everybody could kind of start a business, that it took a while to weed out those that had no business acumen.
Yeah. And of course, it's now become much easier to start a business. I think I think that's probably where broadband networks have really, you know, and of course developments like the cloud and all this kind of rentable, leasable services you can now get for running a business. You know, you don't really need much infrastructure on your own. You can kind of rent it or lease it as you and scale up and scale down pretty easily. You can source, of course, again, using the internet, you can source, you know, your components from all over the world. You can hire software developers wherever they happen to be. All those things didn't exist, certainly in 1999, and that's made it a much, much different economic story for startups and entrepreneurs, even individuals, really can start a business if they've got a good idea. It is much easier now to launch that and let the market tell you whether you got a good idea or not without a lot of time, without a lot of money, and without a lot of risk. And that just wasn't the case back in the late 90s.
In another 15 years, do you think we'll look back and laugh at how arcane our technology is now?
Well, again, I think what we will certainly laugh at is the examples
right.
that we hold up as, you know, being unbeatable Big Bang disruptors. And in fact, you know, having learned our lesson in this book, we start off right in the introduction saying, you know, if you're reading this in a few years, we apologize for all the examples that now seem hilariously funny, because some of them will. There's no doubt. You know, companies rise, companies fall. People, you know, really only takes a few mistakes in this kind of a pace of change to go from being the winner to being, you know, bankrupt. So I think we'll certainly look back on that. I definitely think a lot of the, you know, the technology trends are so exciting and so many things are about to happen. And again, not just with computer technology, but with, you know, with the Human Genome Project, with energy, with optics, with even with, you know, basic material science. Just, you know, I was just listening to a story the other day about, you know, carbon and sheets of carbon that can conduct electricity with no loss of any kind of fidelity. I mean, really amazing technologies are kind of on the cusp of becoming Big Bang disruptors or platforms for Big Bang disruptors. So absolutely, there's just stuff we can't imagine. And yeah, we will look back and we'll say, oh, you know, I was just imagining, we used to refer to cars in the early days as horseless carriages. And I was just remarking that nowadays we talk about the future of cars, we talk about driverless cars. It's the same kind of thing. We don't even have the word yet for what this is going to be.
That is funny. I can't wait till the driverless cars, by the way. But I had to also ask you then, John and I grew up in Ashburn, Virginia, which is where AOL is headquartered. And we saw, you know, we were still in high school when there was the big bubble, and there were just people, young people, I mean, 30, just millionaires almost overnight. And I look back and wish I was 10 years older at that time, and I would have just gone into the right industry and I'd be rich. So if you were to advise somebody in that situation, what would be that technology industry that you would say, go here? You know, a lot of people think maybe it's healthcare or something like that. What do you see as kind of the places where we might see a big influx of cash and talent and change?
Well, you know, I tell you, what we saw in the research that we did was that the industries that were still most heavily regulated were the ones that saw the least impact so far from a lot of these technologies and really didn't experience Big Bang disruption the way, so, you know, traditionally very competitive industries like consumer electronics or consumer products or gaming or even computer industry itself, they didn't look like that. And the problem is that, of course, you know, when you're heavily regulated, there's a lot of disincentives to invest in new technologies, and there's also a lot of barriers for startups to get into those industries. But we are already starting to see that, you know, consumers and technology are kind of pushing on the borders of those industries, and they're resisting so far. But when they break, our belief is that they will sort of change very dramatically, very quickly. So if I were kind of a much younger person today and I was looking for an industry to go into, I would think about things like healthcare, like energy, like pharmaceuticals, like insurance, like banking, places where today the sort of incentive for innovating is kind of depressed by regulation. These are areas where technology hasn't made much of an impact yet, but there's this pent-up demand for it. And when that demand finally kind of breaks through, watch out.
I really like that response. I appreciate that. That was it was fun. It makes a lot of sense. And it gives, I think, some good insight to people who might be trying to determine where they might want to look into. As we've kind of topically discussed it, but now dive into your newer book, Big Bang Disruption, Strategy in the Age of Devastating Innovation. I think one of the words that jumped out to me was devastating. And I was hoping you could dive in a little bit and tell us what you meant by that.
Sure. I mean, I think that we use that word intentionally as kind of a contrast to what's been in, you know, kind of MBA world, the dominant view of disruptive innovation, certainly for the last 15 years with the publication of Clayton Christensen's famous book, The Innovator's Dilemma. What Christensen had written was, you know, in his research from the earlier period was that the way disruptors generally show up in the market is that they originally appear as kind of cheaper but inferior alternatives to existing products. So if you think about, you know, personal computers. Well, when the first personal computers, home computers came out, they were actually kind of terrible computers compared to, you know, what businesses were using and had been using for decades. But they were cheaper, and that meant they could get kind of a foot in the door and start to develop a market, kind of using early customers as guinea pigs and as unintentional funders to actually mature the technology and build a real competitor to traditional computing. And that eventually happened, right? We don't have big mainframes anymore. Now everything is based on kind of what was the personal computer model of you know, standalone devices. The problem was, in our research, was we found is that this pace of change has been accelerating for so long, and the price and performance of these core technologies has improved so quickly that now, when a disruptive innovation enters the market, it often shows up as better and cheaper at the same time. So in the example we gave in the book, if you were making the sort of standalone GPS devices for navigation, you know, the Garmin and the Magellan and TomTom, you had that in your car, you carried that around, those devices were, you know, based on a sort of standalone technology. And under kind of the old model of the innovator's dilemma, when the smartphone first appeared on the scene, and people like Apple and Google started offering free apps that replicated all those services, all the navigation and the turn-by-turn directions and the speaking and the kind of automatic updating and so on, when those first appeared, you'd say, oh, well, great, I've got time now to respond. I can see that they're obviously there now, but they're inferior to my product, so I can now start to figure out how to migrate to the new technology, to the new platform. That would have been the advice you would have gotten from Christensen. The problem, of course, as we know, is when those smartphone apps arrived, they were better and cheaper right from the start. And so if you were waiting, if you were waiting for them to show up before you came up with a competitive response, you'd waited too long. And in fact, that's what happened. Within, you know, 18 months, every measure you want to think about, stock price, market value, sales for those standalone GPS devices, they just crashed. There was no time for a competitive response once the new disruptor had arrived.
After listening to that explanation of devastating innovation, I think it begs the question, can companies keep up with this innovation? Because as you were talking about that, the first thing I thought of was, okay, we've got billion-dollar companies like Google, Facebook, and other multi-million-dollar companies out there. But as soon as somebody comes up with something that's better and either cheaper or at no cost, what's keeping people from jumping to those better things? I mean, when there's a better search engine, we'll move to it. We've done it in the past. So what happens to Google? What happens to Facebook? How do these companies keep up with all this devastating innovation?
Right. That's absolutely right. I mean, that's what we found was that consumers, you know, there's very little loyalty left. And frankly, there's very little in the way of barriers to changing. So when a new product or service comes out that is clearly better and cheaper, consumers, you know, they use social media, they tell each other about it, they're doing all the marketing, and we see these enormous, you know, migrations in a matter of weeks, sometimes days. You can get, especially for software, you can get millions of users to switch to your product very quickly. So what's left for the incumbents? Well, we found there were several strategies that worked for incumbents, and certainly leading companies like Apple, Google, and Microsoft and others demonstrate how you can, in fact, do quite well in that environment. First of all, one thing you can do is you can be the innovator, of course, as well. And one of the great things about companies like Google is they don't stop with one successful product. They don't say, okay, I do search. That's all I do. I'm just going to keep improving the search. They realize that, you know, that's a business that can change. But what they really have is an advantage in information. And they're going to use that information to launch all kinds of products and services. It could be finance. It could be, you know, Google Glass. It could be driverless cars. All sorts of different things based on that kind of core understanding of a of an advantage they have in information. The incumbents can also acquire, and if they acquire early enough, they can get a decent price. So you see, of course, out here in Silicon Valley where I am, the going price these days seems to be about $1 billion for a startup. Once they've kind of latched on and the market has clearly said, wow, we like Instagram, we like Snapchat, we like some of these other early stage products, rather than try to compete with them, if you're the incumbent, you just buy them. And if you buy them, you know, of course, $1 billion is a lot of money. But imagine if you had the opportunity to have bought Facebook or Twitter for $1 billion before they went public. Now you'd be saying, wow, we got an incredible bargain.
It's funny. I just saw, I forget where it was, an interview, I think it was yesterday, talking about how Facebook is just losing a ton of the younger generation. I mean, people are just bailing out of Facebook. And the person interviewing was like, oh, well, is that bad for Facebook? And they said, no, because they're making that up exponentially in older people coming to Facebook, and the younger people are using things like Instagram, which they own. So it goes to what you were saying is, you know, you can either innovate or purchase as long as you're continually making the right decisions.
Yeah, that's right. I think the mainstream media has kind of a herd mentality with tech companies. So as soon as somebody starts to, you know, write the obituary for a company, everybody dives in. It's ridiculous. In the case of Facebook, I mean, they are clearly still making a lot of good decisions, and it's crazy to start to talk about, you know, the end of Facebook, or really the end of a lot of companies that the media, you know, want to bury before its time. One of the things we also found in our research, so even for kind of non-tech companies, for more established companies outside the tech industry, maybe who are not as don't really have their finger on the pulse of what's going on in Silicon Valley and other technology centers, is that they can very cheaply, I think, get access to the entrepreneurs, to the, you know, to the leading edge of things by doing things like, we saw many examples of companies that sponsored hackathons. So these are these kind of contests where they bring a bunch of developers together, give them a task, give them 48 hours, kind of throw some carbohydrates their way and say, see what you can do in 48 hours. And maybe it's a banking application. They say, you know, what can you do, you know, with a smartphone and banking that we haven't thought of yet? So maybe that's a Citigroup that's sponsoring this. And that is one of the examples that we talked about, in fact. And very quickly, you know, they can kind of get insight into where technology from left field that they're not really thinking about might enter into their industry and be one of these devastating innovators. And if they find some good things that they like, they could then say, well, we kind of like that example. Maybe we have an incubator. We'll bring you in-house. You know, we'll co-develop this with you, get it into market. And so they can kind of get around the problem that big companies often have of very slow-moving R&D organizations without having to actually dismantle that.
It makes a lot of sense. And the other thing is, you mentioned it earlier, and it's kind of continued to come up, is with all this change and the rapid pace that it's occurring, there's also the ability to really screw up really fast. And so what is your advice, and what did you find works? I mean, it's terrifying as an incumbent, if you will, that you have all of these resources invested, and one mistake, I mean, almost to one bad tweet can do you in.
Yeah. Well, we, you know, one of the companies that we talked about was the game company Zynga. And this was a really kind of a really sad story. I mean, they had they'd acquired actually the studio that made Draw Something. That was a tablet-based game. Everybody was playing it. I mean, you looked at the numbers, and we did, of how rapidly Draw Something climbed. And it was, you know, adding millions and millions of users every hour. It was crazy popularity. And Zynga very quickly, I think, to their credit, came in and said, we want to acquire this studio and get that into our fold. And so they closed the deal, you know, in kind of record time. Within maybe a week of closing that deal, Draw Something's numbers started to fall. They'd hit saturation. All the people who were going to play it were playing it. They were all sort of starting to get tired of it. And it's just as quickly as those numbers went up, the numbers started to go down. The problem, I think, for both Zynga and the studio that made Draw Something was they didn't have the next thing ready. Mm. And that's really what you know. If you are having this, what we call catastrophic success, where you're getting all your customers are showing up, you know, in a matter of weeks or months, you have to kind of train yourself to think, all right, this is great, but I don't want to be deluded into thinking this is this line of going up is just going to continue going up indefinitely. I know it's not. And in fact, I know because I'm having such amazing success so quickly that it probably means the lifespan of this product or service is going to be much shorter. So I'm going to get all the value out of it early, which is great, except I also have to tell myself, don't be fooled. Don't think this is going to go on. You've got to be ready with the next product or service, or you've got to be ready to say, all right, I'm a one-hit wonder. This was a great success. I'm going to sell this now to some bigger company and let them develop the next platform, let them develop the next generation of it. But if you get stuck thinking my success is going to go on forever, indeed, if you even think it's going to go on kind of for a normal life cycle, that's when you're going to get busted.
Why do you think it is that some of these companies appear invincible to bad decisions or negative press? Case in point, Snapchat. I mean, they had a huge security breach, but they still add millions of people however fast they do. And then kids and I'd say adults continue to send hundreds of millions of Snapchats a day. It looks like nothing that they can do can appear to be wrong. Why do you think that is with companies like Snapchat?
Nothing can appear to be wrong until it is.
Yeah.
And then you're in trouble. Well, you know, a lot of it, I think, is one of the things that we find with Big Bang Disruption is that there's a tremendous momentum and tremendous inertia once these markets take off. Again, consumers here are doing a lot of the marketing to each other through social media, you know, through all the different online tools that we have. And there's just kind of gravity takes over for a long time. And you can weather some pretty big mistakes or some, you know, embarrassments. But that never lasts very long. There's sort of, I think, a mentality, particularly among American consumers, that they really love the underdog, and they're willing to forgive things that a startup that, you know, has a lot of charm. Maybe the founders are very charming. You know, maybe, you know, they just feel like that's the underdog. They're going to forgive things from them that they would not forgive for an incumbent, and that incumbent would really suffer for the same mistake, whether it's a security mistake or a privacy mistake or just a bug that causes outages or whatever it is. The problem, of course, again, is you don't want to rely on that, because the timeline from startup to incumbent gets much, much shorter in this new world. So even if the market is very forgiving of you now, that period, that sort of the honeymoon period, if you will, lasts shorter and shorter all the time.
You know, people always or often, they believe that when we're talking about innovation and change and all this fast-paced thing, it's always technology, which is, as you've mentioned, not always the case, but it's what comes to the front of the mind. And I was wondering, now that technology is expanding rapidly in terms of things we're able to do, it's getting cheaper, people are demanding that they pay less and get more. Do we ever reach a point where it's not sustainable? For example, some of these apps you've mentioned are incredible apps, and people are like, oh, it's a dollar, I'm not paying for it. When do we reach the point where it's like we're not being compensated, or the creators aren't being compensated for fantastic work?
Well, as you asked me that question, I'm reminded of a famous quotation from Winston Churchill, who said, capitalism is the worst system except for all the others.
Yep.
it's true. You know, and he's right. I mean, there's still, of course, plenty of inefficiency and waste in a capitalist system. There's, you know, as I mentioned before, there's this idea of creative destruction. There is a lot of destruction, and value is created and value is destroyed. That's sort of the way that the market works. Right now, I think you're absolutely right. Consumers have been conditioned in an increasing number of markets, again, not just in electronics or computing devices or smartphones, but in many markets, they're now conditioned to expect that, you know, the next set of products will be better and cheaper, if not free, than the ones that they have now. that is sustainable only as long as we continue to experience these exponential improvements in the core technologies, in both their price and their performance. For computers, there doesn't seem to be any reason to believe we won't continue to see that kind of improvement, at least certainly for my working life, but probably for your guys' working life as well. I think you know, that seems pretty safe. There are these other technologies, as I mentioned, that aren't quite as developed in material science, in the human genome, in energy, and so on, that seem to have the potential for being those kinds of platforms as well. And they could lead to trillions of dollars of new economic value. That value can be shared between companies and consumers. That's kind of the way capitalism works. So I'm very optimistic, and I think our research suggested there's cause for considerable optimism that kind of much of this technology-driven improvement is sustainable, and that in fact, you know, it's a source of potentially kind of, you know, reaching the developing world, you know, bringing up the standard of living, not just of people in developed nations, but around the world, in a way that, you know, are kind of our earlier efforts to do that haven't really been very successful. So generally speaking, I'm very optimistic. On the other hand, I don't have as long to live as you guys do, so it doesn't have to last as long for me.
And that's actually a great point. I was watching an interview with Bill and Melinda Gates, and they were talking about how people don't necessarily realize in just a decade or two how much difference technology and just innovation and all of these things have made on the entire world, specifically third world countries, developing countries and economies, places like India and China, and they were talking like Brazil, Mexico City even, have really gone in maybe 20 years from a not so great place to, you know, mildly thriving economies, much in part due to these increases in technology. So although we might not see all of it or appreciate all of it, it is a good thing for mankind.
It's also, I agree completely with what you're saying, and that's absolutely right. It's also, there's kind of a cognitive dissonance among human beings that we just don't see where we were 10 years ago. We can't see it anymore. We kind of look back and we think, oh, we always had smartphones. You know, we always had the internet. We always had the cloud. We always had, decoded the human genome. We always think that we're seeing incremental improvement when, in fact, if we went back and kind of, you know, I like to do this, you know, go out on YouTube and look at kind of news reports from 10 years ago about technology. What's the internet going to do for us? What the world going to be like? And you see just how much further we've come than we could have ever imagined, because, you know, we just couldn't imagine exponential improvement. I think the same thing works in reverse. Looking back, we can't really see how far we've come, you know, in 10 years, in our own lifetime, because we get used to the better and cheaper world very, very quickly. We adapt to it very quickly, and we forget that, you know, we didn't used to have that.
I wanted to ask you a quick question because, I mean, you've written about this stuff in all of your books, basically this awesome trilogy of technology, disruption, and all that kind of stuff. What has been, I'd say, in the last 5 years, your favorite technology disruption that has affected your life on a daily basis? Like, what do you see yourself using the most that's been due to a disruption?
Well, I think the quick answer is the smartphone. I didn't have I was actually kind of a little late to getting a smartphone, not because I was skeptical about it, but more because I was afraid I would be, you know, completely addicted to it, which is exactly what happened. And it, you know, it does so many things. It's replaced so many other devices. It's replaced so many pieces of paper. It's replaced, you know, my flashlight. It's my camera. It's my address book. It's my phone. It's my email reader. It's all these different things. I think that's clearly the one, you know, particular invention. But I think actually even more than that, the amazing thing about the smartphone is that because it's been so successful, we now have, you know, a billion plus smartphones around the world. And what that's meant is that there is an enormous market for basic components that didn't exist before. So for the cameras, for the accelerometers, for the magnetometers, for the displays, you can now buy off-the-shelf components, sensors, all these things you can get very, very cheaply and put them in other things. So, for example, you know, there's now a kind of booming market for personal autonomous aircraft, or sometimes known as drones. You can start buying your own drone now for a very low price. If you actually took the drone apart, what you'd see is a vast not majority, but a number of the key components of the drone are actually parts from smartphones.
That's amazing.
That really
and
is.
That's why you could get them so cheap, because there's this huge market for those parts, and you know, price goes down, and we can make in huge volume and use them for other things.
I'm glad, because I was just looking at buying one of those the other day, not for any particular reason other than, hey, this thing's not that expensive. This
and
is pretty
awesome.
Cool. So I've never thought about the fact that those components were
right.
smartphone components, and now we have access to more products that use those components at a cheap price.
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool way to look at things.
The same is true, by the way, for all the new health and fitness technologies that are, you know, just now kind of getting to that consumer level stage. You know, the trackers, the sort of the Fitbits, the Jawbones, all these different devices that can track your speed, your calories, your sleep, all these different things. If you look inside of them, they're basically a bunch of smartphone parts. You know, the sensors are there, the accelerometer is there, and because you can buy those now in bulk, you can put them into other kinds of products and sell them for a very low price.
I'm so mad that I didn't put two and two together with that, because I sit here with Chris. We always try to come up with ideas of creating that next big product. And I always sit there and I come to that wall and I'm like, oh, but building a prototype probably costs so much money. But in reality, now, when you think about it, it's probably not that too out of the world in terms of like price for building a prototype, because these components have come down in price.
Exactly. Yeah. Prototyping has become something that an individual can do. And if you have a 3D printer, you know, you can print the parts that you don't already have.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned the flashlight on the phone, and the flashlight does not get enough love. I it's one of those things I don't ever think about, right? Like, oh, phone, GPS, blah, blah. I use my flashlight every single night. Every night, that's how I like find my way in the dark to my bed. So I just thought that was funny. But Larry, I know we went over a little bit on time, but it's such an interesting topic and something that's so relevant. People are constantly trying to figure out what's going on, because information is coming at us at this warp speed. And so I really appreciate you talking with us, putting it in, you know, your most recent book, Big Bang Disruption: Strategy in the Age of Devastating Innovation, and helping the rest of the world kind of understand what's going on. I know you write in a lot of places. Is there somewhere specifically that our listeners can go to kind of follow you or learn more or as you kind of put this information out there?
Sure. I mean, we've got a Facebook page, Big Bang Disruption on Facebook, and we always keep that as current as anything with everything that both Paul and I are writing or where we're speaking, or, you know, any news about our research or about the book.
Awesome. Great. And we'll link to all your stuff on the website at smartpeoplepodcast.com.
All right, Larry. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and best of luck with this book. I'm sure it'll do well, as all your other ones have, and we really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Happy to come back anytime if you want to talk more.
Absolutely. Will do. All right. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hope you guys enjoyed that episode with Larry Downs. As we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, we have redesigned smartpeoplepodcast.com. Make sure you head over there, check it out, see what's new over there. We've got convenient buttons to rate us, to subscribe, all that cool stuff. And we've added a blog, and hopefully when you're listening to this, there is content on there.
You know what I just realized? This episode isn't going to go out for a couple weeks, and the website will no longer be new.
The website is always new to somebody.
Good point. Touche. All right, guys, it was great chatting with Larry. Hope it brought you some knowledge on this wondrous day. And reach out to us. Let us know what you think. Keep listening to Smart People Podcast. And as it says on our Facebook page, tell a friend.